Welcome to the Fibery Goodness Tiny Studio Magazine podcast, Tiny Talks, with your hosts, Arlene Thayer, yoga teacher, spinner, knitter extraordinaire, and all-round wise person, and myself, Susie Brown, aka Wool Wench, passionate fibre artist and owner-publisher of indie magazine, Tiny Studio Creative Life. Join us as we chat about all the behind the scenes at the magazine, creative projects we're working on, life and fibre hacks, and just like in our magazine content, ways to boost your creativity and maximize your moments of fiber art inspiration.
Hi, everybody. It is another episode of Fibery Goodness Tiny Talks. And it is me, Arlene Thayer, co-hosting with Susie Brown, our editor-in-chief and publisher extraordinaire of Tiny Studio Magazine. We have a very special guest tonight. We've got our own artist in residence with us this evening, Charan Sachar. And we also have a topic for you, and the topic is experimentation.
That's such an open topic, too. I mean, experimentation comes into almost every aspect of our lives, doesn't it? But of course, we're focusing in on fiber because that's what we're all about. It's all about the fiber. And I just want to sort of talk a little bit about the Artist in Residence program because there might be some people listening that aren't familiar with what we're doing here with the Artist in Residency. It's something we've been running under Fibery Goodness for a few years. We've already had a couple of fantastic Artist in Residence doing virtual interactive stuff through our Facebook page, live streams. We've had some projects. We had Christiane Knight was the previous artist in residence, and we made some really awesome woven pieces with her. And Charan has joined us to do some of his own experimentation with art yarns and actually just getting to know the artist in residence spinning wheel, which is the Mudgercraft Aura. They've also kindly sponsored our program. So this is something that's running for a few months through the Facebook group, and we're also doing updates on the blog, and Charan's doing live streams, and we've got some articles coming up with the next issues of Tiny Studio as well. So Charan, we sent you the aura. What was the wheel you were spinning before, and tell us about the change from one to the other?
So the very first wheel that I actually learned spinning on was the Ashford Traditional, which was a borrowed wheel. And when I went to purchase my wheel, I spoke to a bunch of people and aura came up as well. But I was like, I don't know, which wheel is the best. I kind of want to do everything. Plus, I wanted to learn quite a bit and, attend workshops. And in that case, the Hansen Mini Spinner, electric spinner, was something which people suggested because it's easy to carry. You can take them to workshops, travel with it. So I said, okay. So that actually happened to be my first wheel. So Scotch Tension e-spinner. So many people who I tell that to, they feel you just dove into the deep end like right away. And and then the more I spun on it, I spun mostly traditional yarns on it. And I was very early bitten by the art yarn bug. And I wanted to create these unique yarns, which I found very hard to control on the electric wheel. And that is when I purchased the Lendrum, which, had quite a few options. It had a really big orifice for doing art yarns. And I have spun quite a bit of art yarns on it. The thing I was struggling with that was take up when my yarns got very textured, very complex, and I was, slowing down, speeding up, adding in things, and I was hand winding all the yarn. I used to spin a little bit, then I used to hand wind it on the bobbin. So after seeing several videos of yours, other people seeing my videos, one of them being Evanita, going like, you have to try the aura. And I'm like, I know I do. I don't know how that will happen. And she's like, we will see. It has to happen somehow. And then the next thing we know, we were talking about the Artist in Residence program with me given the opportunity to try this wheel out. So far, yeah. I am enjoying it very much.
Yeah, we've seen you've been really prolific with it as well already. You've spun a lot, which I think your dog Casper is a little bit jealous of the wheel.
He's very jealous. He's actually never bothered me ever if I'm spinning or knitting or anything. Mm. He's always been concerned during this entire pandemic year. You know, whenever a new toy arrives for me, that he goes, oh, there goes the attention.
And He knows.
And once this wheel arrived, he was like, no, this is not happening. And every time I sit on the wheel, he comes and he puts his paws on my legs. He's never done it before.
He's so sweet.
Yeah, so this time he's like, no, not another one.
We've seen him joining in with the live streams. His little feet turn up. He's such a sweetie. But yeah. They know, don't they, when your focus is somewhere. So I guess it was, you know, one of the things that we felt like with the Aura, that it would give you the opportunity to try out those really textured yarns and, you know, lots of different additions to them and multiple plies and so on. So how have you found that? Like, have you been doing your experimenting in a kind of consistent, thought-out way, or are you like me and you're just like, oh, this is a great idea, that's shiny, I'll go and throw that at my wheel and see what happens?
I'm kind of like you, but I also keep thinking and overthinking some things as to how I would go about doing them. So, mm-hmm. I have this idea in my head to create a yarn with actually knots in them. And, you know, knots are always just seen as, oh, nobody puts knots in a yarn. But I said, no, I want to create a yarn with knots. And when I was doing some core spinning earlier, it just struck me while I was core spinning, and I was like, oh, it'll be cool to have knots in the yarn. So I, you know, tried out a few samples, cut off that bit of yarn, set it aside, took notes that, okay, this is how it's going to look, and then continued on with whatever I was doing. So I kind of experiment, take a lot of notes, so that when the next time around I go about, you know, sitting to actually spin the yarn, I kind of know what to expect. So I'm thoughtful in my experimentation. I kind of think it through, but I also want to just try it as soon as possible before
the idea
escapes.
That's actually a great idea to cut that piece of yarn out, because I've done the same thing. I'll be partway through spinning something and think, oh, I wonder what this is like, and I'll try out a couple of things and then end up with a weird patch in the middle of my yarn. I never thought of cutting that out and keeping it as a sample and then just rejoining my spinning. Wow, yeah. What a great idea. After all these years of spinning, there's always something to learn. I really like that idea, because otherwise, you know, it's so easy to forget, and or you sort of, I've got a little list of yarn ideas that I've written down, and then I lose the list. You know, if you've got somewhere you can actually take a sample and put it up and put a little note on what you did,
yeah,
it's a lot easier to come back to, isn't it?
Right, and I also tend to take pictures and just store them on my computer, so it's like a good digital overview of seeing what I have done. And mm-hmm. most of the time, it's not even like writing very detailed notes as to what I did. Sometimes just the visual look of that yarn will remind you that, oh, yeah, this is a good idea, I need to try that again.
And you can deconstruct it, you know, a small piece like that, you can also deconstruct it.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah. I like that part of the experimentation and the whole what if and trying new things that way.
Yeah, it's a curiosity thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a thing up on the wall. I think it's an Einstein quote that says, now I look at it every day, I'm not especially talented, I'm just passionately curious. I really like that quote. I think it sort of sums up everything about, you know, when you're trying stuff out, is that being passionate about your curiosity and following it through and just trying out, not letting things hold you back from trying out different ways of doing something, because you've got to fail sometimes and that's actually okay as well. But if you don't try it, you don't know. So, Arlene, you were talking about a thing that you've got, the word thing.
Yeah.
I really like it. I can't remember what
the
word was.
So in preparing for this talk tonight, I know that people always like tips that they can use, you know, like, okay, as you said, experimentation is a huge word. Where do you even start? Like, if you're a person that's been doing the same thing, you have a default, I sit down to the wheel, I always do this, you know, how do I kind of like break out? What kind of guidelines would I use? So I found this. It's called Scamper, S-C-A-M-P-E-R. And it's a creative technique that you can use to improve your testing, questioning, and tackling different approaches. So Scamper, actually, each of the letters stands for a different approach. The first one is substitution. Second one is combining things, combine. Three is adapting things. Four is modify. Five is put to use. That sort of means, you know, kind of maybe using something you don't usually use. Six, eliminate. What can I subtract? And seven is reverse. What can I do backwards? So as a little example, one of my favorite yarns to spin makes use of combine. And one of my favorite yarns to spin is like a mega gigantical, huge plied yarn, like with many, many crazy plies. And sometimes even having help, you know, more yeah. yarns than I can fit in my own hands.
Do you remember when we did that at
Sway Yeah, Festival? We did it as a group exercise for the Sway Guild. And I love that. So it's like, it's simple, spin a whole bunch of singles, a whole bunch of singles, and then figure out a way to ply them. And it makes a gorgeous yarn.
I think we
yarn.
Had about five people standing around with several singles mm-hmm. in each hand. Mm-hmm. How many plies did we get?
Like you could do, like me personally by myself, I can do up to 9.
That's pretty cool.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, all solid colors, beautiful. So yeah. that's an example. It's really a simple concept, but by layering and combining that simple concept over and over, infinite possibilities.
I've done this idea to combining, as in combining different fibers for a start, experimenting with how your blending can go, maybe drop in fibers that you wouldn't normally use. Like I've combined camel with possum and polewith, for example, those three together, that kind of combining. So you can look at it as a structural combination, or you can look at it as a materials combination, or the combinations of colors that you use together, trying to use those in different ways.
And in combining, I have the last yarn that, you know, I had created, the art yarn, was kind of trying to create a boucle, but it was also at the same time changing the way each of those singles had been spun. Some were coarse spun, some were, you know, spiral plied, where you expect things to be a thinner yarn with a traditional boucle, you do a thicker yarn. So I think I would, maybe that would fall more under substitution, where you're substituting each ply. So it would yep. probably be among that. But that's what it is. You can kind of make the same structured yarn, but substitute yep. every ply for a different kind of structure than you expect.
I did a bulky boucle like that, where I substituted one of the fine plies for a super bulky single, and then used very fine ply around that with a for the boucle loop. So it came out with this big solid sort of center with these little boucle loops wrapping around it. And that was just what you just said, was just substituting a fine for a bulky and changing it around. And also combining and substituting with techniques, of course, yeah. which you've been doing quite a bit of, combining different techniques together into a single yarn that wouldn't normally be put together. I think that's really a fun way to experiment. And we've done quite a lot of that over the years with the recipe cards, and also substituting materials. Like we'd normally do a cable ply, a four-ply cable, and substituting one of the singles for a textured single, for example. That's always comes up with interesting results.
And even using commercial yarns among that structure, you know, you could add just a whole different level of texture and complexity by just using a commercial yarn as one of the plies and seeing how things change.
Yeah, yeah. So what were the other letters?
Well, I'd like to talk about adapt, particularly.
Adapt, yeah.
Because one of the things that I thought would be interesting to get Chiron's take on is I see the wheel, the spinning wheel, as a vertical potter's wheel. Mm-hmm. And with him being an actual potter, I wanted to find out if he thinks of it that way or has thought of it that way or not.
When I initially started spinning, I remember the first half an hour or hour I sat on the wheel, I kind of took to it pretty quick. It was, you know, the treadling motion, the spinning was something very familiar to me sitting on the wheel. And it's more of a muscle memory thing, which was more adaptive to me that, okay, I could just switch from spinning on, you know, a potter's wheel to spinning on a wheel to make yarn. So that transition felt like a very easy transition for me. But as such, I've never really thought of, like, while I'm sitting on the spinning wheel that, oh, this is kind of like a pottery wheel. It's just that there was this inbuilt muscle memory that I have of how my feet and my hands are coordinated. I never had to think twice as to if my feet are going faster, my hands need to go faster. That just was inbuilt memory from me spinning on a potter's wheel.
Yeah. Well, I guess too with pottery, you're shaping something that's already there as well, whereas with the spinning, you're building out rather than shaping up.
When you're plying, I think that you're really sculpting.
True. Plying, yeah. Yeah.
Which reminds me of one of my favorite yarns, Susie, that you ever came up with was Brave.
Brave. Yes.
Even the name implies experimentation.
Too. Yeah. I called it Brave because it is a very bulky single with no twist. I actually spin it with a little bit of twist in it as a single, and then I unspin it as I ply it. And you were talking about knots before, Charan, and what I do with Brave is I actually use a thread, and as I'm unspinning it, I'm drawing that thread down and pulling through a chain and making a little knot.
Oh, I think I've seen it. It's like a half hitch kind of thing.
Yes, it's a half hitch, yeah. And it makes a little bubble out of the unspun single, but because you pull up that half hitch, it locks in the staple, the fibers, so it doesn't fall apart. And it is a really, and I called it Brave simply because I'm like, this is nuts, making a big bulky single and taking the twist out of it and leaving it unspun. And you can see it was really fun to do with the striped top that I got off the hackle. And I developed it because, you know, when you take the striped top off the hackle, it looks so pretty. It's got these gorgeous stripes that go the whole length of it. And as soon as you spin it, they start to barber pole around it. And I wanted it to look like it did when it came off the hackle, this beautiful, gorgeous fairy fiber. So I figured out this way I could add the twist. It's actually a really difficult, even though it's just a single, it's actually a really difficult one to spin because you need to take out the same amount of twist you put in. If you take out too much, you start twisting it back the other way. If you don't take out enough, then it just becomes unbalanced and curls up. And it's also quite a nice felter too. A friend of mine, we spun some at her workshop, and she's a felter, and she's like, oh, let's see what happens when you felt it. And it came out like this really nice sort of bubbly felted yarn. It was really fun. That was a good experiment. Sometimes they work. And you go, yes, this is good. This is what I want.
And you use the principle of reverse too in taking that twist out.
Yep, yep. Mm-hmm. We also used that principle of reverse in one of our modules in the Golden Fleece course, didn't we? Where we actually asked people to, normally you spin going in one direction, it's usually clockwise. Clockwise. For your single and apply anti-clockwise, we actually ask people to spin anti-clockwise for their singles and then apply it the other way. And it's amazing how different it comes out when you spin it the opposite way from where you normally go. And it's really just to like to get out of that, this is how I spin thing, and try something new. And it's quite a fun way to do something new. Just spin it in reverse. And it's amazing the variation you get. It's not what you think you're going to get. So
I remember when I was spinning, when I had just started spinning, I'd spun half a bobbin full, and then I switched bobbins to spin again. But for some reason, I didn't think much, and I was spinning in the anti-clockwise direction. Mm-hmm. And I was spinning my single, and I was having such a hard time. And I was like, it's the same fiber, it's the same wheel, I'm sitting the same way, what's changed? And I almost spun for another hour or so without realizing that I was spinning in the anti-clockwise direction and making this.
Yeah, so why is this so strange?
So sometimes experiments happen by accident as well.
Yeah. So. And that's when it's quite good to remember what you did. I mean, when sometimes you have like that accident and at the end it looks great. And how did I do that? I want to do it again. I've done this with dying on a number of occasions, particularly with dying. It's like, how did I get that? How am I going to get that again? Because I didn't write down what I did. So, and even taking photos. I've seen some of the stuff that you've kept as samples. You did a whole series for when you got the aura and you started spinning from fine through to bulky and writing up how you had the wheel set up. And those are great kind of notes to keep.
Yeah. And
I think it helps with experimenting later.
Right. And it was also mostly because I was trying to get to know the wheel and figuring out the settings of it. So in that way, that helped a lot. But like when you're talking about dyeing fiber, you know how you can dye fiber and then you spin it and sometimes you like the result, sometimes you don't. And then you might like the yarn, but or you might not like the yarn, but when you knit with it or weave with it, you might like it all over again. And then you want to backtrack as to how did you actually dye this fiber? Did you space dye it? Did you dye it in sections? Did you dye it over a staple length? What? So that's from the very beginning, I've been in this habit of taking pictures of my dyed fiber laid out, how I'd laid it out for dyeing, so that later on I can kind of know that, okay, this will give me stripes, this will give me speckles, this will give me barber pulling and all that. So
yeah, good idea. So photo record. That also reminds me with, was it the P, was it put to use? For the P?
What was the P?
Put to use. Because I also discovered that it's a really good idea not to make your mind up about an experimental yarn until you've actually used it. Because I've had a few things that I've made and thought, I really don't like this. I'm not happy with this at all. But then I've actually knitted it or woven it into something and I love it. So sometimes, you know, it's really a good idea to reserve judgment on a thing that you think hasn't worked until you've actually put it to use and see, you know, how it's expressing itself in the project that you use it in before you make up your mind, because sometimes you can completely have a turnaround on it when you use it and realize, actually, that looks pretty good.
So that brings to mind two separate thoughts. One is when I was learning to quilt many years ago, and the teacher was teaching us how to pick out the fabrics. She said, okay, you need a solid. You know, that could be black or white, maybe even navy, but you need a solid. You need some prints, fine. And you need maybe three or four of those. And then she said, and you need an ugly. You need an ugly. And it's that little something that maybe isn't all that appealing to you, but it just adds that certain little note. I was in a bobbin challenge with Melissa Yoder Ricks of Wild Hair Fiber one time. And in that bobbin challenge, she sent me an Angora poncho in a dusty pink and duct tape that had Justin Bieber on it. Justin Bieber, it was white duct tape, and Justin Bieber was purple and black.
Oh, wow.
And hair ties. Like,
that's evil.
Black hair ties. And that yarn came out so awesome with all those ugly. And the duct tape, which, you know, I used like a ply, like I folded it in half and I kind of used it like a ply, but... like those were all what I would consider on the surface uglies. And if Melissa, if you're listening to this, it's you did a good job challenging me. I'll put it to you that way. But anyway, so that's what you're saying about put to use. Like, don't judge it on the surface. Yep. Like, it could really work out.
You might need that little dash of unpleasant. Yeah. Yeah. Although I wouldn't go as far as Justin Bieber again. But I thought you did a magnificent job with what you had. Okay, it's kind of like, you know, five uglies make a beautiful in that case.
Keep, you know, my old motto was keep plying until you get something.
Yeah. Keep going.
Ply your way out of it.
Turn into something.
It's like with the quilting thing too, right? When they say you have ugly fabric, they just say you haven't cut it small enough yet.
That's right. That's exactly right.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. Well, I tend to do this, put the ugly in with when I'm making bats more than when I'm doing the yarn itself. I'll do it into the bat. I'll get a colour that I think isn't going to work and just put it into the bat somewhere, and especially for art bats, of course. And it's often amazing the result you get. And I discovered when I was doing a lot of optical blending with the hand combs, you can add colours in that you would never do when you were painting, for example. If you've got, like, you've done a beautiful blend of yellow and blue and you made this gorgeous green, and then you add in some neon orange. If you were doing this with paints, it would go this pretty yucky brown colour. If you do it with an optical blend in fibre, it gives you this gorgeous, soft, heathery blend because it doesn't actually mix those colours together, only optically. You've still got every colour is still an individual colour in that blend. So I've actually found when I'm doing the hand combing with the blending that putting in the ugly really can make it quite beautiful in a way that you would not normally think to do if you were following the colour chart and colour theory, you would not do it. And that's also why, like, you know, when we did our big book of fiber rainbows, Arlene, we were sort of like looking at all the rainbow colours. You don't have to stick with the colour chart. We didn't put colour theory into that book because it's actually quite, for me, working with colours, quite an intuitive experimentation. So adding neon orange into a green was really like an eye-opener for me. I discovered it was actually really, and then of course you put on a little bit of gold Angelina with that and you just got a gorgeous heathery blend with it. But that I would not have done that if I wasn't, you know, if I didn't want to take a risk, I would never have got to discover that. So I think risk taking is actually a big part of experimenting. I don't think that's in the scamper thing, but I think it maybe it's a scamperer at the end. Add another R to it.
You know, one time Susie came to visit. Well, she's come to visit a couple of times, but this one particular time, somehow we ended up in the house by ourselves for several days, and we were in a mad dash to produce. We were in a mad dash to produce these fiber kits for this event that we were doing. And I remember two things about that week. One was I cooked a meal, which we then ate the whole time. Like I cooked this gigantical, actually it was Indian food. I cooked this gigantical amount of food and then we did nothing but eat this food because we didn't have time to do anything else.
Just microwaved it.
Right. The other thing was you were putting safety orange in every batch of dyed fiber. So it's really funny that you brought that up because I remember that very distinctly, like, whoa, she really likes that safety orange that goes into everything. It's like her Tabasco sauce.
It is. It's amazing. Safety orange and neon yellow. Oh, my God. You can make so many things with those colors.
Orange is one of my favorite colors as well.
Yes. Yeah, we've seen quite a bit of orange. It's so vibrant. I can always recognize your yarns now by the colors that are in there.
I have to come clean about something that I've never been to art school. Some many people know that because, you know, I've studied as an engineer and done my master's and all of that. But I can never understand, like, the color wheel doesn't come intuitively to me. I have to physically look at it every time because I have never thought of the... when I put colors together, I just go so much by my gut feel. Like, this will go well or that will go well, or and sometimes it doesn't work. But I just go so much by feel that my color combination, that's why I land up being a little different than, you know, something picked out of a color wheel as, oh, these are analogous. And I've tried to study about it a lot. I get it, but my mind doesn't function that way.
Yeah, I think there's a few people like us that do that find color tends to be an intuitive thing, and it feels like if you start to get into the theory of it, it feels like you're actually overthinking it at that point. But then there are other people that's how their brain works. They use the color wheel and make some amazing combinations out of it. It's just a different way of attacking the same thing, I think, and coming out with a result at the end. It's really interesting, though, that some people really think of it intuitively, and other people really think of it as a conscious decision making process in the colors. But it's also a case, I think, and this is where experimentation comes into it too, is it's really easy to get stuck in a color rut. Like, for a while, all my yarns are like purples and greens and blues and, you know, dual colors. That was what I was doing. And then when we were doing the rainbow book, everything was a rainbow. I was so pleased to actually finish all that and do some, you know, muted colors and earthy colors. And, you know, yeah, that was fun. But the experimentation with colors is quite an exciting thing. And this is the thing with fiber. It goes on and on, doesn't it? It seems never ending how you can combine things and try out new things and learn new things.
I wanted to ask the two of you for your opinion on the timing of experimentation. So there's something to be said for really learning the foundation of things, like knowing the rules to break the rules, right? But on the other hand, there's the beginner's mind, which may introduce something into an art or a skill just because you don't have preconceived notions. So I'd like to hear from both of you which of those perspectives you sort of lean more towards.
Oh, I can go first. I think I like to take a learn the rules to break the rules approach. However, I'd like to also say it's good to try and keep a beginner's mind in, like, oh, what happens if I put these things together? Because I don't know, I haven't done it before. So often you're sort of a beginner every time you spin something in that way. But I do think for what I like to do, which is multiplied, highly constructed yarns, I think you need to know the rules in order to break them there, because it's all about twist management in the end. So that's probably the short answer from me.
For me, it's kind of similar, where I feel that, you know, you kind of need to know the basics as to how things work. And once you're confident enough in that, then you can break the rules, change the rules, and all of that. What really helps me in coming up with newer ideas, because if you're so caught up in the process of these are the rules and I need to abide by them, is listening to beginners who come up with, you know, their questions or their curiosity as to, oh, did you do that? And then, you know, you try to think, yeah, what if I did that? And that kind of leads to more experiments and leads to, you know, breaking your own set of rules, which are in your head. And comparing to, you know, how I started doing pottery when I first entered my first pottery class, I said, I want to learn to make teapots. And the instructor was like, no, you don't make teapots the first time. You learn to throw a mug on the wheel. I said, no, I have paid for this class to learn to make teapots. I want to make teapots. And she's like, no, you learn how to make a mug first. And I was disappointed the first day that, oh, this is going to be useless because I don't want a mug. I want a teapot. And I mean, I started with that intention, but just knowing that basics of throwing a good pot on the wheel and how to alter it to change it, you know, helps. So similarly with fiber, if you can spin a good consistent single or an inconsistent single, but you know exactly how to create both of them, then you can experiment and change things later on and play around with the idea.
Yep. So I guess it's a little bit like if you want to repeat what you're doing as well. Like we were talking before about accidents. As a beginner, you tend to have a lot of accidents and think, oh, actually, this worked really well. But it doesn't mean you can repeat it again because it actually was an accident. And it's not always possible to repeat an accident. And certainly with dying, this has always been my problem because I have a lot of, you know, dying accidents or I get stuck with, you know, orange. I think I really like that idea of listening to people's questions about what you're doing too. I hadn't sort of taken that on board in this as like a motivation, but I think you do pick up a lot from when people, and I guess it's like when you're teaching, you're also having to, you know, when you start doing something and you've got it, you've mastered it, you sort of end up doing things automatically. But when people start asking you questions, you actually start to break it apart again and say, oh, this is what I'm doing. And you break it back down into its steps in order to explain it. And that can give you a whole lot of new insights as well when you do that, rather than just, you know, defaulting to what you usually just do because that's what you do. Not even to do with rules then, I think. It's just, well, this is what I always do.
Yeah, similar thing comes to mind as to, you know, I core spin a lot. Susie, you do quite a bit as well. And I'm sure you get this question 101 times as to what core do I use? Like, yeah. You know, it's always this biggest mystery as to what core should I use. And yeah. With that, I've always told people just experiment, you know, whatever yarn you have lying around. Use that. Yeah. You have sock yarn lying around, just use that. See how it comes out. Yeah. And but at the same time, it's like when, you know, a person asks you and they said, well, I have this acrylic yarn I got at the big box store. Can I use that? I'm like, try it out. See how it works. And that actually had led me to try out acrylic yarns for some of my core spinning. And so these kinds of questions which come up, you know, always lead to more experimentation and learning the craft in a whole different way. Even though you know the basics, you know what the best core yarn is and all of that, but just being open to the idea that there are other possibilities.
Yeah, I've actually been consciously stopping myself in the last few months because when you do get asked the same thing over and over, you tend to come out with this kind of stock answer and then you just keep repeating that stock answer. And so the last few months, I've actually been consciously stopping myself doing that and thinking, actually, is this really true? Am I just saying this because I've already said this, you know, a few times now? Or, you know, is there some other alternative? And something came up about blending boards a while ago. It's like, you know, can you do this on a blending board? And I'm like, actually, I've always said, no, it's not great for that. And I still think, no, it's not great for that. But you could actually do it. So maybe I shouldn't say no. And so I've been kind of rethinking a little bit because I guess when you've been doing the same thing for a long time, like I said, I end up getting stuck in this rut of this is my answer, but that's not necessarily the only answer. And I guess that's the other thing too, is when it comes to fiber, there are so many answers and everyone can have a different one and they're all correct as well.
Well, everybody, it's not getting to be that time. I hope you've enjoyed listening this evening, this afternoon, whenever you're listening at your convenience. We have enjoyed immensely being together and having this conversation. Looking forward to seeing more from Turan during his residency with us. And we'll be back, I guess, in a few weeks, right, Susie?
Yep. We'll be back in, I don't even know what month it is already, and we're only, it's January. How can I miss that? We'll be back in February with the next episode. We'll also be back in February with the next issue of Tiny Studio Magazine, which has an article from Turan with his experiments in pictures in the issue as well. So we're looking forward to that. And thank you, Turan, for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure having you along to chat with us today.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure hanging out with you and talking about what my life always seems to be, just full of experiments all the time.
That's a good thing. Bye, everyone.
Bye.